40 years ago, this week, I arrived here in Rockford from California to be the intern minister. The pewter and tan winter was giving way, transforming into the green grass and the white and yellow petals, just as they are now. My very first act as an intern minister was to lead an Easter sunrise service on the 10th of April out on a lawn outside. I was young, 26. I was tremendously naive. Fair to say that though I am not quite as naive and certainly not young, I still tremble now and then. I served here just 6 months. Much less than intern ministers serve now. Things were different back then. But in that short 6 months, oh my goodness, here in Rockford, so much. I didn't have a place to stay, but I stayed in many places. I lived with families for 1 month at a time, like the Elkies, who had a large rambling house and a dog that didn't like me very much. I covered for Mabel when she went on vacation. I had to retile the Arnold's kitchen because I almost burned it to the ground because of a cooking fire. Sue Hall opened her large family's house to me too, and several others housed me as well. It was a very rich time, and I learned a lot as a young seminarian of 26. I turned 27 while I was here. I was a very fortunate intern, very fortunate. I first met the great Maya Angelou when she preached in this pulpit, gave an extraordinary lecture. I can still remember almost everything she said. I got to work with her years later at a conference, and she always remembered her time here fondly. I was fortunate enough to learn the history of this church, not all 175 years, but a great portion of it, from the horse's mouth, that is actually two horses, namely Alan Deal and Jack Mendelson. Alan Deal was here to help burn the mortgage when I was here. I had to make a little flaming chalice to burn the mortgage. That was one of my intern duties. I picked up Alan at O'Hare, brought him into Rockford, and then he gave me a tour of the building, which he will still tell you is his building, not yours. he took me on a tour of every brick. I swear he knew the names of all the people who had laid the bricks. It was amazing. And former minister Jack Mendelson came by when he was running for the president of the Unitarian Universalist Association against two other guys in those days. He came to stump for that office. Well, here, he didn't win. But I had a wonderful conversation with him in Tony's office. Tony Perino was the minister then. In Tony's office about his experience in the old brick church before this was built. I remember so many things. Nora Borland taking me out to see a patch of prairie to tell me about the flora of the Midwest, of the prairie. She knew I was a Californian by that time, and she wanted me to know about nature here, because I knew a different nature. I did a lot of pastoral work while I was here, too. I visited the hospitals many times. I remember especially visiting a young man, 22, in a hospital who, because of a tremendous electrical accident, lost his arm. And I learned at that moment that what a minister is somebody who simply shows up. No magic, nothing else, you just show up. I also remember some atypical times for an intern. I remember rafting down the Wolf River one weekend in Wisconsin with some people in the church, with all the cottonwood fluffs blowing into my eyes. And Lainey Van Royen, the religious education director, engaged me to chaperone the Sunday school kids on a week-long archaeological dig of Mississippian culture 4.5 hours south of here, not too very far from the ruin of the great metropolis of Cahokia near St. Louis, which I had never heard of once in my education, my very good education, a city near St. Louis built in the year 1200 with walls around it and 25,000 inhabitants in the same year when Paris had only 10,000 people and London had only 10,000 people. And I was angry when I found out about that, and I've been angry at a high level ever since. It was a great education for an intern minister. This church, 175 years old, intersected with my own personal history of 67 years, as it has intersected with the lives of so many other people. I only lived through a small part of its history. Some of you have lived through considerably larger percentages of the church history. In its history, this church has gone through so many transformations, from ministry in the days of abolition and Stephen Douglas and Lincoln, through the theological controversies about God and Jesus and humanism, to the argumentative days of the consolidation between the Unitarians and Universalists back in the 60s. This congregation has been reincarnated anew many, many times, has seen many ministers, many building projects, many friendships, marriages, memorials, divorces, many children once skipping through the halls, now graying at the temples. Like a river in time, this church is not so much a fixed place on a certain piece of geography, but it's a flowing stream washing the shores decade after decade down a whole length of time. Each decade has been different. For example, small one, the old brick building, when they led worship on Sunday in that building, there was never a flaming chalice. That wasn't invented until much later. And the songs we sang this morning, with the single exception of the Mozart, probably, would have probably perplexed ministers and music directors back in the Civil War era. The idea that the Bible, however progressively interpreted, is not read every single Sunday would have caused serious heart flutters amongst the earliest church members. And this very fine building designed by Alan Diehl's close friend, Pietro Belluschi, would have probably horrified the architectural critics 100 years ago. It's just a great big block. What kind of a building is that? Just as the delta of a river is not the same thing as the mouth of a river, the present Rockford Church is not going to resemble the first Rockford Church at all, not just in building, location, and structure, but in the culture of the people. And even the church I served as an intern is not the same as the present one, for so much is transformed in a mere 40 years. Yet here I am now, here we are now, on Sunday morning in April, 175 years after the founding of this congregation. And so today, since the theme this month that has been established is transformation, I want to address that theme and our history in this way. 3 years before I entered seminary, I helped an old college friend move into a new home in Ludington, Michigan. He was going to work in the school district there, be a teacher. As we unpacked everything in the third story of a gorgeous Victorian house, we found a secret sliding door in one of the closets. Being curious, naturally, we slid it open. It opened easily. Inside, in the dark, we found a velvet-wrapped box. We took it out, carefully unwrapped it, then opened it up, and we found inside the box, of all things, a clarinet. The woman who rented the third floor to my friend was in her 80s, and she had been born in that house, as had her parents. We showed her what we found. She was totally surprised. She had never known about any secret compartment any place in the house. We asked her, "Who in your family played the clarinet?" "Why, no one that I know of," she said. "None of us were terribly musical. I have no idea how it got there. But please," she said most graciously, "if you would like it, please take it. I certainly have no use for it." I have carried that mysterious instrument with me wherever I have lived. I don't play clarinets either. And it has no reed, and there's a sad crack in the dark wood. But to me, it's beautiful beyond words. The shape, the elegant sculptural stops that you use to play, the color as dark as night, it's gorgeous. I have it hanging up in my loft in Columbus. I checked with the clarinetist, Richard Stoltzman, when he was in town to visit his son and daughter-in-law, who had grown up in the church I served. And he figured from looking at it that it was over 100 years old, because all of the stops were different from modern-day clarinets. He had no idea if it had ever been played. But clarinets are meant to be played. They're not just there to hang in my loft as a display of sculptural beauty. They are meant to bring music alive. And as you heard in the first reading this morning by Cody Della Strate, some music, like the Mozart clarinet concerto that he heard in that cafe, actually has the power enough to transform a human heart. He tells us that his despondent, broken heart began to mend due to that music. He even tells us that his heart had been so broken by the fight he had with his wife that he began to lose his hitherto comforting belief about a just and saving and omnipotent God. It was then, as he deeply questioned his belief, that the waiter put on the recording of Mozart. And his heart then began to heal. He describes the music by a rather traditionally spiritual word, quoting another critic, mercy. The concerto was mercy. And then Della Strate does an interesting thing. He fuses that word mercy to some very scientific words about the brain coming out of neuroscience. Reflecting deeply as the music plays, he absorbs both the spiritual word and the hard science ideas and combines them into the idea of human feeling being first and foremost. He speaks of the chills we feel at the climax of a song or musical piece, like the choir sang this morning, for example. Then he links Mozart's arching theme to his own personal transformation, his dawning sense that reconciliation with his wife was possible, which began to stir deeply within him. It's the experience of the music and the feeling it released in him which begins to heal him. His religious beliefs and doubts, both, he comes to understand, are just propositions or lists of assertions or skeptical blows. You know, I believe this to be true. I don't believe this to be true. Suddenly it dawns on him that the feelings come first. The propositions, the interpretations come second. His felt experience of the harmony in the music leads him to a renewed harmony in his own heart. All of this because of what the clarinet was doing while being played by the musician. Note the beauty of the clarinet itself was not an issue here. He couldn't see what kind it was or its age because it was recorded music. The clarinet, so to speak, was taken out of the velvet box and was being used for the reason it was meant to be used, to create music that invites transformation of heart and action and thought. I think the same thing is true about our Unitarian Universalist spiritual tradition. Just like a concerto, its themes and even its practices move and soar. They flow, also like a river. They transform theme and variation from decade to decade instead of from a musical scores page to page. For instance, here's a concrete example. I mentioned it before, I'm going to unpack it a little bit. 40 years ago, only a few of our congregations kindled a chalice at the beginning of worship. The congregation I served in Hayward, California was the very first to use it back in 1963. Many rejected the idea or hated the idea and were angry about it. It reminded them of rituals that maybe they had left behind when they were younger. Now, 99% of the congregations in this country and in Canada and around the world that are Unitarian Universalists kindle the chalice, love the simple ritual, love the children who light it. Was there no aspiration or ceremony before the chalice was created? Of course there was. But there is a resistance among theologically progressive people to changes in institution, much more so than in conservative churches who change the institution all the time but have a rigid theology. It's an interesting observation. Now let me get more social now. 40 years ago, there were very, very few women serving in our congregations. Very few. Those that did would report rather sexist put-downs from some members of the congregations they were eventually called to serve, for whom the idea of a woman in the pulpit was somehow threatening. Yet now, women make up over half of our numbers of ministry. When I left this church internship 40 years ago to finish school and enter my first ordained ministry, there were no ministers who happened to be gay or lesbian in their personal lives, at least not openly. Certainly, I have to report that I was turned down for that stated reason by seven congregations as I was in search for the ministry, churches that never read St. Paul or Leviticus on Sunday morning. Why? Because Unitarian Universalists over time sometimes fail to realize that they're part of the larger flow of culture, the larger river and stream that carries us down, and don't understand our possibility to transform ourselves and be a counterculture to what is the accepted stuff out there. Little by little, we're learning. So the beliefs and unbeliefs that people had from the social reality outside the walls of what it meant to have a woman in the pulpit or a gay man in the pulpit or a woman in a wheelchair in the pulpit or a man of African ethnicity in an historically Eurocentric congregation, all of these beliefs and unbeliefs had to be tossed in order for anything to happen. As the beautiful story this morning made pretty clear, it was no longer a question of looking for theological realities elsewhere, on the other side of the hill, on the other side of the river. It was a question of paying attention to what was going on in between people here, in the congregation, in real living relationship and encounter, real human lives. We are still working on this and we have far to go, but we're working on it. There was a big tumult this week. Some of you who are visitors and some of you who don't get online don't know about it, but the president of our association quit this week, Peter Morales. And I'll let Matthew talk about it when he gets back in greater detail, but it did happen. And it was over issues of hiring practices of the UUA, where people of color were feeling marginalized understandably so. Here, in this late in the game, after all the work that we've done, so many of our ministers went to Selma. So many went to Selma. And now people are beginning to realize that this is Selma. Selma is where we are, not a place to go over the hills, over the mountains, but here is where the work needs to be done. This is good stuff. This is hopeful. People are talking about it. People are expressing that. But so much of what's out in the outside world leaks in through the walls unless we deliberately push it out and transform ourselves, allow ourselves to be transformed. I've seen a great change in 40 years. When I came into the Unitarian Universalist Association in Michigan when I was a very young man, it was all about belief and unbelief. Theology was a big thing. Are you a humanist? Are you a theist? Are you agnostic? What are you? What category do you belong to? Well, that's changed a great deal. And I've changed a great deal. I have seen a greater movement about moving toward a cultivation of awareness that the world does not revolve around me, to quote the second reading. That the world does not revolve around me, but it revolves around every individual together in community. And that together we have to make a community that is open and broad and aware and awake and not slave to or subject to what goes on outside, unconsciously, moving toward unconsciousness, toward consciousness. We've been doing this for a long time about women, about GLBTQ people, and so forth. It was interesting when I was serving the Hayward Church, I had an intern with multiple sclerosis. She was in a wheelchair. She could move her arms, she couldn't move her legs. She was a great intern. She came to our church to serve as an intern because we were the only Unitarian Universalist congregation in the Bay Area, 9 million people, about 15 congregations. We were the only one where she could serve. We were the only one where her wheelchair could make it into the church, into the bathrooms. There were steps and so forth, and no ramps. And that told me something too, a lack of awareness about certain things, especially now as we age, people like me, you know, my hearing's going. I don't know about yours, but my hearing's going. That is a difference from when I was younger. So my intern used to have a bumper sticker on her car that said, "Disabled, sooner or later." I used to say to her, "You could just take that bumper sticker, hold it up on Sunday for 20 minutes, and then roll off the chancel, because that would be a fine sermon right there." But because of what the second reading said, I want to go into that a little bit. She recognizes that beliefs and unbeliefs are not the issue. The idea is being fully present to mystery, not thinking you need to have certainty, not thinking you need to have a category once and for all. This is who I am. This is what my identity is. Identities flow and change like time flows and changes. And recognizing this, and the younger generation in our movement are recognizing this so much better than my generation. So much better, and I'm so moved and proud. When I left my congregation to retire, 700 people, large church, they thought they would have to call a minister who had had 90 years experience to come and take care of a big church that way. I said, no. Nowadays, you can get somebody right out of seminary, and they'll do a fine job because they're trained a lot better than we ever were, a lot better. And they know a lot of this stuff, and they've gone past this idea that belief and unbelief is what's important. It's not a weakness, it's not flimsiness, says Hazelton, clearly rolling her eyes. I'm still seeking, but I'm not lost, or if I'm lost, I'm happily lost. I'm also a scholar of religion. I have taught New Testament in both of our, several of our seminaries. I love doing that. I've taught worship. I've taught UU history. I can read the Greek. I am a scholar. Just because my feelings come first doesn't mean I've given my brain up and put it on a hat rack someplace. It's simply that language like saved, wanting to live forever, the various religious words don't mean anything to my experience. I am somebody who wants to be alive and live my life and see the tree and see the people and have a conversation, find depth, God, if you will, depth, the holy, not superficiality, and real meetings with real people, hearing their stories over time. I'm glad there's going to be people telling their stories down below today. I'm speaking only for myself. For some people, the idea that feelings come first is a little troubling. They have a harder time with their feelings. I've had to struggle with that too. But I have to be more honest that it is my feelings that come first and the interpretation comes second. I have a great deal of faith, and I want to be clear about that. I have given up using the word belief and unbelief as a spiritual practice in my retirement. I don't use either word ever in any sentence. But I think I have a great deal of faith. Faith means confidence. It doesn't mean a list of beliefs. After the Protestant Reformation, some people made that mistake, and in this country it's gotten really bad since the whole decision to make the Bible inerrant out of Oberlin, Ohio in 1888. That concept is a new concept. Fundamentalism is a new concept. It kind of has ruined a lot of stuff, it seems to me. But I have faith that I can go forward. I have faith and trust in my own feelings, that when I see a lonely old man in the park hunching in his wheelchair, or I hear about an angry African-American man, a veteran, being treated as someone who doesn't exist, or when I hear about another outrageous shooting, no matter where it is or why, or if I listen to a friend talking about a terrible quarrel with his wife or his husband, or I hear the tears of another friend who's breaking up with her transgender partner, I trust, I have faith that my feelings are telling me something that helps me to respond faithfully to their conditions, their needs, their suffering, by at the very least showing up. I don't offer magical solutions. I don't work miracles, but I can show up. I don't want to argue about Jesus. I don't want to argue about God. I don't want to argue about hell. These, to me, those kinds of arguments, is there a God, is there not, are futile tennis matches, futile tennis matches across an imaginary net. I want out of the game. I don't want to play it anymore. I want out of yes and no. I want out of the everlasting conflict between believers and unbelievers. If someone asks me, well, what do you really believe? After I've said something like that, I won't talk to you about it, okay? Don't ask again. I'm not having a secret here. I'm not holding something in, you know, in the back of my mind about what's the real truth. I am living into the truth day after day as best I can. This is someone else's game, not mine, this whole business of debate. As I celebrate the 175 years of this congregation, I want to say this. For those 175 years, we have indeed offered a kind of spiritual music that transforms both ourselves and the world. But the two are together. If we think that we are the saved and we're going to go out and transform the world and make everything else okay outside, and we haven't looked in the mirror ourselves, we're fools. We've made a mistake. It has to be a combination of these both. Always removing the shards of external habitual reality around race, around gender, around everything, to be pulled out of our flesh and to heal in this place. There's lots of themes and variations in the river that flows through time. But the main theme of the song, no matter how it's played, by word, by action, by organ or piano, the theme is always very similar. It's principled. It's depth, not superficiality. It's kindness, not judgment. Our ancestors spoke of the worth of every human person. Long ago they spoke about that. We're still discovering what that means and what that looks like and how we are responsible for making that real in our lives. We have always taught universal love, not theological terrorism of sending people to hell. 40 years ago, 100 years ago, 175 years ago, their spiritual clarinet had different stops, but they played the best they could, and we're playing the best we can. The music that has the power to transform broken hearts, we're playing it ourselves. We're living the music. That song that Mozart played, well, that was Mozart's era, but the song that we sing goes back a lot earlier than Mozart. For hundreds and hundreds of years, going all the way back to Arius of Alexandria in the 4th century. And here's the lyrics to the song, in case you've forgotten. As you love yourself, so love others. And always struggle to tell the truth while living your life, not letting it live you. And be aware, oh yes, be aware, that the world does not revolve around you, and that justice is not for others, but for all of us together equally. So be it. If you would turn to 27 in the gray books, or look at the screen for number 27, I Am That Great and Fiery Force, the song of Hildegard of Bingen and Josquin des Prez.